Hello, film fans. Hope this finds you well. Thank you so much for choosing to listen to my little podcast, Soundtracking, that Ben and I make every week, where we dive into the beautiful minds of people in the world of film and TV and music to talk about the wonderful relationship between the moving picture and music. I also encourage you guys to get in touch with various things, which is so wonderful. I've had some really nice correspondence over the last couple of weeks from people who want to come on the podcast, which is great, to directors, new directors who are inspired by what they hear, which is great. And then I love this one, actually. And this is from Paula. She says, I don't think you have chatted to this particular movie music composer, but I love his soundtrack so much. I was hoping he may feature in a future episode. Fernando Velasquez, my favorite podcast. I look forward each week to each new episode. Paula, I'm definitely going to look into that because I'm not sure how much he's worked on things recently, The Orphanage being one of my favourite of his scores and films. What a terrifying and brilliant film. It's a perfect time of year to be watching something like that, isn't it? Halloween, so which is when I'm recording this. Happy Halloween, everybody. So I will definitely look into it, and thank you so much for your email. Really, really appreciate it. We have got some amazing guests coming up over the next couple of weeks. I thought I would just sort of throw forward to a few of them. Lots of people returning to the podcast, like Luca Guadagnino is coming back to talk about his new film Bones and All. We spoke to him the last time about Call Me By Your Name, the beautiful Call Me By Your Name. Bones and All is out in cinemas at the end of November and stars Timothée Chalamet and is Taylor Russell as well. Beautiful pairing. And it's a pretty extraordinary film. Also going to be talking about After Sun, which is a feature film debut by a very talented Scottish director called Charlotte Wells. It stars Paul Mescal from Normal People, and Charlotte's done a phenomenal job with this film, so we've got her coming up as well. Alejandro G, the G stands for González Iñárritu, the award-winning director and writer, his new film Bardo. I haven't had him on the podcast before. I did get the chance to chat to him loads about The Revenant, and this film Bardo has got such a personal attachment to him and his family and his story, and I loved chatting to him. It was absolutely brilliant. Tim Burton is going to be on the show talking about his first foray into TV series Wednesday, which I've seen all of and loved it. We've also got Sebastian Lelio talking about The Wonder and many, many more. But today we are celebrating some of the most iconic film music of all time as Matt Whitecross and David Arnold join me to discuss Matt's documentary, The Sound of 007. Sorry. It does exactly what it says on the tin, featuring contributions from many of the key players from the franchise's 60-year history. David has, of course, scored 5 Bond films, so we're going to begin with one of his cues from Casino Royale, Nothing Sinister. Thank you both for doing this. Oh my God, so great. I'm so glad I get the chance to talk about it. I want to say huge congratulations. It's the most wonderful. It felt like I was in some kind of time capsule watching the doc, because I felt I was just transported through different eras of my life and moments and memories of growing up, not just watching the Bond films, but I think, you know, the thing that the film celebrates is how important the music and that song was to everyone's experience. So it was amazing to kind of just be reminded of ones that you'd forgotten about as well.
It's so true. I mean, that's the, you know, I every time I make a film, you always try and make the next thing as a kind of reaction against it. You want to do something a bit different. And I've done a few music films, but when you get the chance to make a film about the music of James Bond and work with people like David, it was kind of too good an offer to turn down. And you realize, I mean, you know this anyway, obviously, but from my perspective, you go into a project like this knowing that this music is part of your DNA just from growing up in England, I guess, well, all over the world as well. But then as you start to do the research, you really start to remember how important that music is to you, how integral it is to just the way that you see the world. You grew up with it. Like a lot of these tunes were there before I can have any real memories. So we were talking about this the other day, that my parents, I've got young kids now, and when I read to them, and you get to that point of the evening where you've definitely got to call it a day, and they start complaining, oh, one more chapter, you go, no, to be continued. I did this thing, which I suddenly realized my parents did to me, which you just said, you go at the end, you go, da 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 da. And I was like, oh my God, they've been singing me the Bond theme. So I must have heard the Bond theme since before my first memory. Yeah, it's
That's
just
awesome.
part of everything that, yeah, it's part of your identity, I think.
Was it a case of Barbara and David just kind of getting in touch then, Matt, and going, how did this project kind of come about, really?
Well, had been working with John Batsick, our producer, and we talked about lots of different projects, none of which had come together. And we were working long term on this Paralympics project. And then he rang one day out of the blue, this is all pre-COVID, saying, listen, would you fancy going in to meet Barbara and Michael, Eon, at the Bond offices? They've got an idea, but they don't quite know what it is, and they want to have a brainstorm. Do you want to go and meet them? To which the answer, of course, is yes. Of course, I would love to go in and meet Barbara and Michael. And if nothing else, just to be nosy and kind of can see what that world is, because I think we've all got an idea in our minds what that might be like. And they've got, the best reputation in showbiz for a reason, I think. So you go in there, they're incredibly charming, despite the fact that they were in between directors, I think, at that point on No Time to Die. So they had bigger fish to fry, but they were obviously thinking ahead, and they knew that the 60th anniversary was approaching, and they wanted to commemorate it in some way, but they weren't quite sure how they were going to do that. And they thought probably they wanted to do a documentary, but at that point they didn't know what it was. So we just had a brainstorm and threw out a bunch of ideas, and then we didn't hear back. And so I assumed that someone bigger and better had got the gig, and I kind of tuned out of it, and we went off and made another film. And then about a year later, John got a call from Barbara saying, listen, where is this film that you promised us? At which point it was like, all right, all hands on deck. And of all the different ideas that were mooted, I think Barbara had the thought about doing something about the music because, uniquely, I think amongst films, music is always important in film, but I think uniquely with Bond, it's kind of integral. It's been there from day one. If we talk about that Bond theme, Bond doesn't really exist without that theme, without the music of John Barry and Monty Norman. And as it in increasingly that template is something that distinguishes itself from everything else. If you look at other big films, if you think of Raiders of the Lost Ark, or you think of E.T., you think, well, I'm just naming loads of John Williams films here, and Star Wars and so on. But they, as important as the music is, it doesn't really evolve. I think that what I love about Bond, this is something that Phineas said to us when we met him and Billie Eilish, was that he loves the fact that it's each of these stories is set in the present day. And so the music has to reflect that, and it has to reflect Bond, and it has to reflect the artist as well. And that makes it unique, I think, in music history.
David, whenever I think of Bond, I do you for me, you're almost kind of like the gatekeeper in a way of it, because I feel like you've had such an important role in terms of keeping it alive, really, to be honest. When John kind of decided that he that was kind of, and he talks about that in the film sort of thing, kind of that's I'm kind of done. I've done what I can do. And he saw you and he felt like you were the person to hand that baton to, which we've talked about on this podcast in the past when we did the lovely episode with you and Don Black. But it was so important because there was a danger that Bond could have stayed quite kind of period almost in a way. And he needed an update and he needed that. And that needed to be musically as well as with a new Bond actor, playing the character. And that was down to you. That was kind of, you came in and really sort of shook it up a bit and brought different genres into while still being so respectful, and of that kind of original sort of sound and stuff as well. Was that anything that was that ever sort of talked about in terms of the music feeling like it needed to be updated in a way? when you came in?
It wasn't. And I tell you what, one of the things that makes Barbara and Michael really great producers is that they kind of cast their crew as they would their characters, I think. Mm. I think they cast the people that they think are best for the job at that particular moment, and they let them do what they want. In many ways, they're a bit like the safety bumpers when you go ten-pin bowling with little kids. You know, it's like they make sure that it doesn't go, you know, into the next lane. Yeah. It's still heading in the right direction, but the route, you know, to the strike is you know, you still got, that's where you've got to head. And you know, and they know these things inside out. You know, they know what is and isn't right. But the fact that it's kind of supported so many approaches over the years would tell you that the actual character and the world of the cinematic James Bond can support quite a few different approaches. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think before I even got involved and you lay these songs side by side, if you laid Goldfinger next to You Only Live Twice, next to Nobody Does It Better, next to Live and Let Die, you know, they all sound completely different.
Yeah.
And they're all, you know, but they're all Bond songs and undeniably Bond songs, and yet they sound completely different. And I think it's continued in that vein, you know, since the mid-90s, really, since Eric Serra kind of properly took it to a place that I don't think anyone was really expecting in terms of you know, the kind of electronic approach with orchestras. So you know, and it's, you know, it's survived all of those things.
Yeah,
I think that's why I love you know, my favorite parts of the Bond movie are the beginning and right at the end. You know, at the beginning, you've got the gun barrel with the promise of the greatest Bond film that's ever been made about to happen. And at the end of it, if maybe it wasn't your favourite, it's got those immaculate words, James Bond will return. So you go like, well, maybe the next one will be my favourite one ever.
Yeah.
And for some people, you know, certainly I've got my favourite and, you know, and I'm happy with that. And I don't think anything will ever beat it. But there's something really exciting about the fact that it might do, you know, there's another one coming and it might be your favourite one. So that's what's exciting about it.
I mean, in terms of the film, it'd be great to kind of talk about, you know, you kind of feature in the film, but it must have been a lovely journey for you watching the film as well, kind of thing, and sort of, because there's some amazing stories come out of this, the doc. We've lost Matt for a second. I'm hoping he's going to find another hilltop to rejoin us. But, I mean, I didn't recognize Sheena Easton for a start. I was like, that's who it is. I was like, oh my, because the accent's totally gone. It was like, but I was like, that was amazing. And that whole Tina Turner song, you know, that was written by Bono and The Edge, which I think I knew about, but there's all this lovely footage of him singing it and that whole story, and kind of just, that's the great thing about the doc, is like almost, there's a little kind of almost short film around the making of every, not every song, but quite a lot of the theme tunes, which is so nice, kind of gives context and the journey of them, the decisions being made, and that brilliant bit where George Martin kind of goes, no, if you want Live and Let Die, it's Paul, kind of thing. It's like, well, of course it is. There's some great stories.
Why would you want Thelma Houston when you've got Paul McCartney? You know, I mean, nothing wrong with Thelma Houston, but you've got Paul McCartney. I know that was always George's story. When you were young. To say, live and let live. You know you did. But if this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry, say, live and let die. You know, but there's a story attached to pretty much every one of those songs. And the thing about watching that, the documentary was, I mean, I knew a lot of it, but you're kind of struck by how much wasn't there. You know, it's like, if you think we've had 60 years of this thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's an awful lot of stuff and an awful lot of ground to try and cover. And I'm sure Matt was equally as frustrated with, you know, a 90-minute cut, because, you know, seriously, you're 4 to 6 hours to properly have a look at it. I mean, I did that radio show looking at the scores, and that was 6 hours of audio, and that wasn't enough. You know, you kind of scratched the surface of it. But there are so many stories, and what's extraordinary is that, you know, again, 60 years later, we're still talking about it.
Do you know what one I've been singing nonstop since I watched the doc? Can you have a guess?
Go on.
Which one do you think I've been singing nonstop?
Well, I tell you what is really
all the time in the world.
But that made me cry.
I've been singing "License to Kill." Nice. Weirdly, because we did it with Ella Eyre at the Albert Hall, and for some reason that whole song properly took off in a way that I'd never expected it to. And so ever since then, I've just been going like, "I got a license to kill, to kill."
So, Gladys Knight.
Walking around singing that all the time. Yeah, Gladys Knight.
I've been singing Shirley's version, "The World Is Not Enough," like literally walking around all day, being Shirley, like for days now, being Shirley Manson, like in that kind
Shirley
of.
Shirley was so excited.
I love that story that you told.
To be doing it. But what was really fantastic was that when we did the Albert Hall and she came, luckily the whole band came over to do the show at the Albert Hall. She seemed as excited to be doing that as she was when we did the original recording. I mean, it's like, I love it a bit. Yeah, it was a lovely night, and I was just saying Matt that you know that you feel the restrictions of 90 minutes when you're looking at 60 years worth of material to try and to plow through, and that really it's a 6 to an 8 hour, you know, like the Beatles movie in a way, you know. it needs that amount of exploration, because the stories are all unbelievably entertaining and enlightening, and of course everyone knows these songs. You know, they've been around in our lives since we were obviously born. And so, you know, there can't be that many people left in the world who haven't been around when Bond's been around. You know, a bit like the Queen.
The geek in me as well, with all that sort of that lovely sort of pull through from "We Have All the Time in the World" right through to kind of Billy's song in the last film sort of thing. I mean, that's an amazing insight with like Hans's kind of craft of kind of taking all that kind of it. And seeing Billy do that kind of bit of performance at Air was just kind of jaw dropping when she was like, "Can I just do it? Can I just freestyle? Can I just a cappella it?" Yes. It's like, wow. Well, I mean, you must have just had so much footage of stuff, Matt, to kind of, like David was saying, to kind of know what to kind of navigate your way through it, really.
Well, that was the challenge for me, was that there was, so the joy of it was that there was so much. We knew that going into this, there were so many great stories. The music was so easy to talk about, because sometimes music is hard to talk about. But I think with Bond, it's easy because we know it, and there's so much history. There's so many personalities involved. There's a lot of great anecdotes, and also you can kind of dig into it, because, you know, we wanted to show, for example, how a genius like John Barry could take the Bond theme, but then adapt it so that it would play at the same time as Diamonds Are Forever, and do all these things. And you can just show it there because we know both of those songs like the back of our hands. So yeah, the problem was we knew we only had 90 minutes, and we kind of, I think I just decided early on, okay, fine. Well, it's really just going to be a taster. You know, people can come to this and it will draw them hopefully back to the music and back to the films, but we can't do every single song justice. In the early cuts, we tried to. So everything was in there, from Madonna to, you know, to Aha, to all the tracks that I'm sure people are angry that we didn't include were in there originally. But it just got to a point where you just had to go, okay, look, we're going to have to try and give a taste of all the different things that Bond music can do. And sometimes if two tracks, for example, you know, we had a certain point, there's the anecdote, which was hilarious to me, of how Duran Duran and John Barry fell out. And on the one hand, you have someone who's like the consummate professional who turns up every morning. And then you've got the new IT band at that time who want to do things their own way, which is fair enough. And initially they clash and there's a friction. And then gradually there was a kind of mutual respect and they came up with this great tune together. Meeting you with a view. Face to faces, secret places, feel the chill. Nightfall covers me, but you know the plans I'm making still overseas. Then all more or less the same thing happened with Aha on the next film. And it was another notch. I don't think they ever really, the grudging respect bit never really came around. So they just hated each other by the end of the process. When we had that,
a bit like
that
the band. In it,
yeah, exactly. And then, but there was like another 10, 15 minutes of Aha. And even though that was the, you know, one of my favorite songs growing up, because it was the first Bond film I saw in the cinema. And I remember rushing out of the cinema and going to HMV and buying that single and so on. So, you know, that song has its lovers and its detractors, but it was huge for me.
Fading.
So I, when coming on board, I was like, of course that song's got to be in the film. And then when we cut it, the idea was, well, look, haven't we just said that with Duran Duran, that John Barry was getting to a certain point in his career where he didn't really feel like he needed to put up with this. And he also wanted to go off and stretch himself in a different way, which I think inevitably after you've done 11 films, you start treading some of the same boards and you feel like maybe he could go and do something else. And in the original cut, we then went off into this whole thing on the rest of his career. But I think, you know, understandably, people came back and were like, well, you're starting to make a John Barry documentary here rather than a Bond documentary. Maybe you need to kind of pull it back and concentrate on the on Bond. And so, yeah, there was a lot of stuff that we wanted to include. And there's a lot of lovely footage, a lot of lovely anecdotes. It just wasn't time to do.
That's a bit, I hadn't really seen him talk much, really, in terms of, I've heard him speak about it, but I hadn't really seen much footage of him. And it was so interesting. He's so kind of, I mean, David, you got to know him really well, didn't you? You kind of, he was like, I mean, he didn't suffer fools. I love his kind of, just, he's so just kind of dead, like this is kind of, you know, this is how it is.
It was cutting. I mean, he was always the kind of belligerent Yorkshireman, you know, no matter where he was in the world, his opinions would always be really, you know, quite brutally honest. And he had a very high standard, you know, which is why I never spoke to him about anything that I'd done. I thought that the last thing I would want in the world is to have John Barry's axe fall on me, you know. So I mean, we used to talk about a lot, but and I saw him a lot, but I would never talk to him about music, especially about Bond music, I think. You know, otherwise I would be that guy. I would be that annoying person saying, in Thunderball, blah, 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 when you did that with the flutes, and then why did, you know, the whole thing. I'd be like, you know, ripping it apart, like trying to find out where this comes from, you know, the genius of creation, how, you know, why that set of sounds, you know, why that approach. Because you always think like, well, there must be something that he knows that I don't, which makes him amazing. So you're always trying to find out how other people do this job as well. You know, I'm sure, I know it's the same with filmmakers, but you think like, well, maybe they know something that I don't, some sort of magic trick or a hack which makes the ordinary turn extraordinary. But you know, there never is. It's just innately within you or it isn't. So I never used to talk to John about anything like that. And I wouldn't, you know, because he would have told me, and I don't think I was ever ready to hear it, because I doubt if it would have been, you know, I don't know. He was nice enough to Barbara and Michael when talking about Tomorrow Never Dies, whether I should be doing it or not. He was very, very kind. But you know, I figured like, well, don't ask, don't tell. So I didn't ask. We just used to go out to dinner and everything, and he would drink and I would eat. And he said, David, I'm a drinker, you're an eater. I'm like, well, that is absolutely right. Don's fantastic story about, you know, it's like we'd have the Pontrachet, champagne cocktail, a brandy, and then we'd have lunch. You know, that was always his story about John. You know, it's like Don went out for dinner with John, and it was always about like the cocktails and the amazing drinks and everything. And you know, maybe there'd be some food, or maybe there wouldn't.
That lovely story from Michael Caine as well, of just like being kept up by the piano playing. That was so great. Yeah. I mean, you must have unearthed some amazing footage as well, Matt, in terms of there's some fantastic archive in there as well.
There was a lot of stuff. I mean, I was very relieved and happy that, you know, we started doing these interviews, and I'm trying to remember the order we did it in, but I think very early on we spoke to Barbara and Michael. Before doing the proper interviews, we kind of sat down with them and just asked them a bunch of questions. Then sitting down with David and Don pretty quickly in their studios. And then as far as the new film went, I think I'd been reading some of the stuff that came out when the film came out, and I heard about Billy, you know, contributing to the soundtrack. And I think I kind of subliminally, I was hearing it when I watched it for the first time, but then I went back and saw it the next day again, just to listen to it this time, because I closed my eyes at points and I could hear her coming in, but it's done very, very subtly. I should have known. I'd leave alone, just goes to show that the blood you bleed is just the blood you own.
open. You were my life, but life is far away from fair. Was I stupid to love you? Was I reckless to help? Was it obvious to everybody else that I
So then talking to someone like Hans, and Hans talking about the process, I was like, was anyone there filming? Because I come on board after they'd already finished that part of the process. And he was like, oh, I don't think so. No, I don't think anyone was shooting. Like, I was thinking even just on their phone. But actually, it turns out Barbara and Michael have been very diligent about doing everything kind of behind the scenes, not only for the shoots, but actually for all the post stuff. And so, yeah, someone was in there for any of the key bits with Johnny Marr and the key bits with Billy and Hans. And that, which was amazing. I mean, like you say, the idea of just being a fly on the wall at these iconic moments was great. And then similarly, when it came to David, not even David remembered that the classic, now completely iconic moment where him and his team performed the Bond theme for the end of Casino Royale, which is up there in one of my favorite movie moments ever.
Totally.
And someone was there, was filming it. Obviously, they were so in the moment, they didn't realize there were any cameras there.
Was that amazing to see, David?
I mean, the thing is, I never filmed anything that I've ever done. So all the things I've ever done, I've got no record of it. I haven't even got photographs. So it was like on Casino Royale, I asked Michael Wilson, I said, look, Michael, I said, like, we've done, this is like my fourth film now. I said, like, could you take some photographs? Because Michael's very keen on photography. Could you just take a few photographs? So he came along with recording stuff. And I think he got that on his stills camera. I think it was Michael who filmed that. I'm not sure that we had a camera crew, but it felt very intimate at the time. And of course, I got sent a couple of shots that Michael had taken of me with, trying to get the sound right on the guitar amp when I had long hair and everything. And but the actual moment of doing it, I didn't know had been recorded. So I was watching the documentary for the first time and I thought, like, oh my God, that's the moment. And it's like, you can see it on my face. And weirdly, and I don't, this is probably on purpose because, Matt's a brilliant filmmaker, but that clip was sort of followed a clip from John, where John said when he was recording his Bond theme, when something magic happened, and something magic happened at that time when he was doing his. And when I did mine, it felt exactly the same. It was one of those things that completely had a life of its own, and no one knows why. It's one of those things where all of a sudden everyone's slightly sitting slightly higher up in their chair, a little bit forward, and giving it absolutely everything, and all of a sudden this thing just comes to life, and everyone knows it. Everyone who's playing in the orchestra is looking at each other in their eyes and knowing that this is the one that's happening. And then you're in it, and it's like it continues to be brilliant, and then it's just like riding a wave. It's like surfing. And at the end, you think, like, oh, my God, that was amazing. We did another two or three takes for safety, and they were all flat in comparison. It just didn't have the same thing. And it was that one. It's one of those odd things, isn't it? It's like when you go and see a play sometimes, you can see it on a night where it's absolutely astonishing and electrifying. You can see it on another night where it will feel, a little bit flat and low energy. And I don't know if that's something to do with the audience and the performers or a mixture of both, but I think part of it, for me, was when we did it, is I'd saved it to the last thing we played. So, the band had been, we'd been doing this Bond movie for about 6 or 7 days, and we hadn't played the Bond thing. And everyone knew it was coming. And I put it right at the back of the pad. So it was like the last thing we do. So, and because it was an end title, it's like you can kind of throw the book away, because you don't have to, you don't have to be in sync with anything. And so we just, everyone was just going to enjoy it. And I think I'd got the guitar sound sorted out for the first time properly. Everyone was ready to play it. And when we did play it, you listen to it now, you can still feel the energy. And I was, immensely pleased that it sort of became Daniel's version of the Bond thing. Mm-hmm. That version of it became his. And I think it was in all of his movies, I think. ¶¶
I think as well, like that choice of Chris Cornell for that tune as well, for that was such a great kind of extension almost of the character of Daniel as Bond, I think, as well. That felt like such a lead through on that. When you were, so say for example, with that one, when you were in the studio recording that amazing moment and we see the footage, was the theme already done? Had Chris already done it or what? Because that's the thing that I find interesting. Yeah. It's kind of like it, sometimes there are, it's different for every film, really, I think. It's what I kind of get.
The songs always sort of have to come first in a way, because poor old, Daniel has to animate the title.
Yeah.
You know? So he needs everything as soon as he can. And Danny Kleinman, that is, who makes the title sequences for the Bond films, and is an extraordinary talent. So he's always badgering me when I was doing them, can you get me something? Can you get me something? Because he needs to know what's going on. So we found that the songs kind of happened kind of like November, December, January-ish time to be finished by kind of like early Feb. And then you would start writing the score February through summer.
To sometimes weave those in, wouldn't it? That's the thing, is like those kind of themes are weaved.
Yeah.
You know,
you have to have it elements. First, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to have it first, really. So I worked on that with Chris separately until we had a version of it. And we had the finished version of it at the wrap party for Casino Royale. So Casino Royale had wrapped, the film had wrapped, and there was a party for the crew and the cast, and everyone wanted to hear the song. So I got in this, I think it was a Mercedes with Barbara Broccoli and Daniel Craig and a cassette in those days. And the first time he'd heard it was we were in the car park at the back of this rap party, and we played You Know My Name, and that's when he heard it first. And Barbara hadn't heard the mix with Chris's vocal on it, only my sort of demo.
Amazing.
He seemed very happy. Right. And from that point on, you know, Barbara then gives a speech, because at this point the crew are wrapped, right? So everyone's going home. They've shot this thing. It's taken months. Everyone's relieved. Everyone's going home. And I'm walking up there going like, well, now I'm really just starting. You know, it's a very weird alienating thing to be at. She said, anyway, so we're all done. You know, Barbara was being like lovely and charming as ever. And then she looked at me. She goes, "Now, David." She goes, "Now it's over to you. It's all down to you now."
Jesus.
and I literally got in a cab and went home. I thought, I can't stay here anymore. I've got to get going. I started writing that night.
If you take life, do you know what you give? I'll tell you, won't like what it is. Storm arrives, would you be seen with me by the merciless eyes I'm deceived? I've seen angels fall from
I was just going to say, one of the highlight for me of David's concert the other day was him singing the theme that you did with Chris. I think it was very moving. I mean, he performed it beautifully, but it was, you know, having grown up with Chris in the Soundgarden, that was one of the key songs for me. And then to hear you perform it, because obviously he's no longer around to do it, it was very moving.
Yeah.
Well, you're very kind, and obviously I couldn't go anywhere near the sort of thing that Chris can do. So all I had was I excused myself and asked for his blessing. in his absence. But I didn't want to not do that song.
Yeah,
And the other
totally.
weird thing was, I was halfway through that when all of a sudden I realized I saw Paul Hollywood in the audience,
From
and
Bake
that
Off.
kind of slightly pulled me out of it for a second.
Oh my God, that's genius.
I should have asked him for a
That's
handshake at the
so
end. I don't know
great.
what I was
You
thinking
absolutely should
of.
have. A couple of quick things before I let you guys go. I love as well how there's you're not within the doc, you know, it's not just all kind of light. There's a bit of shade in there as well in terms of when things either haven't worked or, you know, like the radio, the kind of being up front about the Radiohead thing as well. And I think that was that's really great as well of kind of, and Sam Mendes is brilliant about it, just kind of going, oh, it's broke my heart kind of thing. That, and then also when the odd Bond song hasn't really kind of worked, really, you know, it's like over like 6 years, you're never going to nail it every time as much as they try, sort of thing. And I think it's great
No.
that it kind of goes there.
Well, it's funny though, because I think they didn't want to make a puff piece. It wasn't supposed to be some kind of EPK. But what's interesting though is as soon as you start to criticize any Bond song, there's a whole army of fans who are like, that's the best one.
Yeah.
You know, so All Time High, for example, I was having an argument the other day. Well, not even an argument, because I do love that song. But they were, and a friend of mine was saying, I can't believe you cussed it in your film, even though it wasn't me doing it, saying, oh, it's the best Bond song of all time in the Jarvis
Oh,
Cocker
come
version.
on. No, it's not.
So, you know, it's good. And the same thing for Living Daylights. When I was talking about how much I love that song, someone else was telling me I had
That's
no
it.
taste in music. So, you know, it's good. There's something in there for everyone.
Yeah, it's conversation, isn't it, as well? And it's kind of, yeah, it's experience, people's experience and moments and stuff as well. It was very, very emotional as well, because I remember watching the, you know, the little doc that they made with Daniel, kind of, you know, being Bond sort of thing, to then follow up with this. And you kind of, he was such a great Bond, you know, he was so brilliant as Bond. He really, really was. But what's great about the doc has been reminded about all those other, you know, actors that have played it over the years. Personally, I think it's time for another Scottish Bond. I think Jack Loudon should be for me the next Bond, but that's just personal take.
It's funny how, I mean, you know, going back to the music, I think it'd be so interesting to see whether it's David or whoever ends up doing it next. You know, how do you then evolve the character? Because I think something
well,
again,
David's going to be the next Bond. That's amazing.
you heard it here first. But the in terms of who does the music,
you notice
I
I'm not saying I'm not.
You've got to keep these options open. They're exploring all possibilities. I just think that, you know, whatever happens next, it's got to kind of speak to the times. It's got to speak to who the new Bond is and what the new story is.
Yeah.
But I found that fascinating. The time of, you know, again, in the longer cut of the film, we had a whole, there was a real, you know, David Arnold love fest all the way through. And we had a lot on Casino Royale because I suppose, well, to put words in your mouth, David, you had a kind of challenge of like, how do you distinguish this new Bond who's already controversial? People saying, oh, we don't want Daniel Craig. He's not right for it for whatever reason. And how do you make him emotive when he's not an emotive character? Well, you kind of, you have to do it through the music, and that's where you get that emotion. And I think particularly with the Vesper theme, which is a kind of back and forth between these two things, it has to come through the, you know, through this kind of the, you know, the doomed love affair, because it's not never going to come from Bond, because Bond's someone who conceals for a living. So I did that. I found that fascinating. But David, take that all apart. I was in geek heaven. Unfortunately, we didn't have enough time to, but you know, maybe in some longer cut in the future.
Thank you. before I let you go, what your favourite Bond song?
You Only Live Twice, my first movie.
We Have All the Time in the World.
I
think that's the best song, but it's not my favourite.
Yeah, that's the thing. There's a distinction there, you're right.
I didn't realise it was one of the last things that he'd done as well, or the last thing that he'd done. That was kind of like, just broke me when I was watching the film. I just thought it was really, really
I think that's the power of music, isn't it? Sorry, go on.
But what's interesting is about when you have a definitive reading of it like that, it's almost impossible to get close to the weight that he brought to that lyric.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because when I did it with Iggy, it was like, well, he's the only person I kind of know who has lived a life that is so rich and so full that when he sits down and starts reflecting on it, it's a similar amount of weight. You know, it's a very different tone, I think, you know, but what I liked about his reading of it when I did it with him was that it felt like it was coming from a similar place, you know, a kind of like, not exactly the autumn of our years, but, you know, but kind of like a reflective looking back kind of thing, while still kind of pulling forward as much as you can. And, you know, there's very few people who, you know, it's interesting, there's very few people who can sing these songs well. You know, they're very, very difficult to sing. You know, John's melodies especially, I think, are incredibly challenging to pitch right, you know, and they kind of play incredibly easily, you know, when you have them in your head, they're incredibly easy, but they're really technically very difficult to sing. So anyone who takes one on and makes it work, you know, I tip my forever worn hat at them.
Well, listen, thank you so much. I mean, thanks for this, because it was just such a beautiful experience watching it. Really, really was. It was lovely to watch.
Thank you, Edith.
Yeah, I wanted more, but I look forward to Matt. I look forward to what's next, and from you too, David, as well. And it's lovely to have you both together to talk about this. Thank you so
kind.
So much.
Thanks. I'm sure Matt's got like a 6-hour cut somewhere for us. I mean, I'd watch all of it.
Yeah,
I have. Well, it's. I mean, I probably should say that Edith was a very big part of the longer cut, where we went into a lot of detail about John Barry and Aha. Which you were both, you were excellent on both, in both cases, and they all hit the cutting room floor last minute. So I apologise for that.
Hey,
but yeah,
Matt,
the longer cut
won't be the, out there. It won't be the last time. It's not the first, and it won't be the last, my friend. So don't you worry.
Well, listen, nothing can't be improved without having Edith in it.
Oh, take care, guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
bye, guys. Lots of love.
Bye, bye.
Have all the time in the world, time enough for life to unfold all the precious things love has in store. We have all the love in the world. If that's all we have, you will find we need nothing more.
From Her Majesty's Secret Service, that's We Have All the Time in the World, composed by John Barry and performed by Louis Armstrong, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Matt Whitecross and David Arnold. Now, before I let you know what's coming up next time, a word from our friends at Vintage Cash Cow. Now, if you've heard me say on this podcast before, I do love a cosy, clean home, which normally requires a little bit of decluttering. That's usually a pretty stressful task, even with the most wonderful music blaring. Now, given that most of my drawers and cupboards are full of things that haven't seen the light of day in years, well, Vintage Cash Cow makes selling your old valuables easy because you don't have to deal with selling items individually. All you need to do is fill a box with jewellery, cameras, coins, vintage toys, or whatever you fancy, and post for free or arrange a collection. Within a week, you'll get a cash offer. If you accept, you'll feel better, knowing your unused things have become part of the circular economy, which of course is good for reducing waste and tackling climate change. You'll have a more relaxing, spacious home and a clear head. Vintage Cash Cow has great reviews on Trustpilot and right now are offering listeners a £20 bonus with the code SOUNDS. Another reason to put some music on, have a good old rummage and a clear out and fill a box for Vintage Cash Cow today. So if you feel inspired, head to vintagecashcow.co.uk now, enter the code SOUNDS on the sign-up page and get £20 extra when you sell. That's vintagecashcow.co.uk with the code SOUNDS. My huge thanks once again to Matt and David for taking the time to talk to us. You can watch The Sound of 007 on Amazon now. Here's hoping Matt gets to release the director's cut one day. I'm not bitter in the slightest. Head to edithbowman.com to hear every single episode of the podcast, including my previous chats with Matt and David. And don't forget to subscribe while you're there so as not to miss my conversations about film and music the moment they land in the future. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And please, I love getting emails from you. And you can do that by sending one to info@edithbowman.com. Next up, very excited to welcome back the phenomenally talented Ryan Coogler, who is taking us back to Wakanda with the new Black Panther film, of which I haven't seen yet. But as of recording this, I'm going to see it tomorrow and chatting to Ryan on Thursday ahead of you hearing him next week. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.